Good morning. Good morning. So now that we're all positioned a little more comfortably, we can get started, and I apologize for the movement and the late start of the meeting. My name is Nicole McElvin. I'm a senior project manager with the National Quality Forum and also heading up this project with a few other staff members from the National Quality Forum. Good morning and welcome to the Healthcare Disparities and Cultural Competency Consensus Standards Project. I want to make sure that everyone is here for this meeting because we do have also another NQF meeting going on across the hall for our Measure Applications Partnership. We are going to jump right into the agenda and get started. A few logistics. As you all can see, we have breakfast and drinks in the back of the room. As you speak, be sure to use the mic. The meeting is being recorded, and the only way that we can record is for the mic to be on while you're talking. If you do have questions throughout the meeting, our normal protocol is for you to place your name card upright, allowing the co-chairs and other folks to be aware that you do have a question if you do during the meeting. I think that's it for logistics. Let me just tell you who else we're here with other staff. Behind us on the table, we have Elisa Manthali, who you all may have been communicating with, and also Kristen Chandler, who's a project analyst. And I will let the coaches introduce themselves.
Good morning, all. It's good to be back at an NQF meeting once again for me. This is the second time around. I also think somebody thought it was a good idea to pair Dennis and Denise together. This is the first for me. So you'll have to be a little bit precise on if you're addressing us by our first names. I just wanted to mention one or two things from the conference call that to keep in mind as we go through the couple of days here that this meeting builds on a significant body of work that's been done by NQF before. There are a number of reports that you have appendixed to the work that we are looking at today. So there's an opportunity to kind of be added on and add on and integrated to existing work, as well as the hats off to the folks who wrote the paper for this meeting, Joel and Joe and others who wrote that comprehensive and very thoughtful piece give us a lot of fertile ground to build on. So I want to thank them for that great work. And so as we go through between the work that's been done before by NQF and others, and as well as the paper, keep that in mind as we have an opportunity here to not only build on what they have done and take off and variations on a theme, but set directions, agreement, consensus will be part of this process. And something I remember from that phone call is whether we're asking the right questions being a good part of what we need to consider here, as well as the importance and feasibility of the points that we'll be pursuing. So with that, I hand it over to my colleague and say welcome.
So good morning to all. Dennis and I are going to do a bit of a team tag here. This was probably the most difficult day for me to accommodate in my schedule. I did not want to say no to the honor to be invited to be a co-chair. I'm actually in two different meetings and I'm on call starting at 9 a.m. So I will have to apologize because I will be stepping in and out. Dennis is going to do the heavy lifting today and I'll have a little bit more leeway tomorrow. So with that, I'm going to take my 9 a.m. conference call. It takes 5 minutes and I'll be ready.
Great. A few other things I wanted to mention. I just want to make sure that everyone received an electronic copy of the materials that were emailed out to the group. We have also printed a copy of those same materials and placed them at your stations. There was a small memo that was accidentally left out. We have printed and included a copy of that. It's about a 5-page document that was also placed at your station. This memo is really a more detailed copy of the agenda. The agenda had a few questions teed up for each section that we'll be discussing. The memo had a little more detail to it. So as we go through the sections of the paper and the different discussions, you may want to just reference the memo as needed for that additional detail. And so we're going to then move into our disclosure of interests and or maybe introductions, and then
often we've done them at the same time.
Yes.
So they get close together. So let me just give you a little background on what we're about to ask you to do. As you may remember, when you submitted your materials, you filled out a disclosure of interest form. We're asking you to orally disclose anything that may be relevant to the work of this committee today. So we don't need a full list of who you're a member of, any of that, but any grants, any speaking, anything that may be relevant to what will be discussed, we're asking you to just state that to everyone. The other piece that I would just remind everyone is you are here as individuals, not representing the organization you work for or who nominated you. That's something we like to remind everyone. But let me stop and see. I'm seeing some, maybe some questions. Does this make sense, what we're about to ask you to do? Okay. So just, I would do introductions and then just go around and say if you have anything to disclose. If you don't, feel free to say I don't have anything to disclose. Ramona, yeah.
Does that include what we've already listed, or if we've already listed it, then can we just...
We're asking you to repeat.
You are.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anything you have, just briefly give a high level what it is and nothing more than that, just who it's from and what the focus is. Let's say if it's a grant. That's it. So not to put the chair on the spot, but would you like to be the person to start?
Yes, I'm Dennis Andrulis. I have nothing to disclose. And I am Dennis Andrulis. It's easily forgotten. Dennis Andrulis, nothing to disclose.
For a few more examples, but okay. Grace King, I work for Well Center. I'm not representing them today. And I am currently receiving a grant, and I'm the lead PI for Barbara Wood Johnson Foundation Finding Answers grant.
I'm Luther Clark. I'm the Global Director for Scientific Affairs at Merck Pharmaceuticals, located in, a number of different places, White House Station, Rahway, and West Point, New York. I'm a cardiologist by training. I've been at Merck for approximately 4 years. Prior to that, I was the Chief of Cardiology at Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn and Director of the Brooklyn Health Disparity Center. Other than being an employee at Merck, I have nothing else to disclose.
Hi, I'm Liz Jacobs. I'm at the University of Wisconsin, Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And I'm not sure this is a conflict, but I'll mention it anyways. I'm on Aetna's Racial Ethnic Disparities Advisory Task Force, and I receive an honorarium for being part of that.
Good morning. I'm Ramona Hussain-Winia, and I'm with Northwestern University in Chicago. And I don't believe I have any conflict of interest or anything to disclose. I do serve on an ARC technical advisory panel on creating the evidence base for disparities and the quality gap. And I do have a consulting role with the Henry Ford Health System, so I'll leave it at that.
Good morning. I'm Marcella Nunez-Smith. I'm faculty at the Yale School of Medicine and affiliated with Yale New Haven Hospital. I am also PI on an NIH grant to develop a measure of healthcare discrimination. Other than that, I have nothing to disclose.
Good morning. I'm Norman Otsuka. I'm a pediatric orthopedic surgeon from the NYU Hospital for Joint Diseases. I'm on the Diversity Advisory Board of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. I've taught some courses on communication and diversity. I have no other disclosures. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Mari Udelman. I guess I should disclose I'm a lawyer. Not a conflict, but other issues involved in that. I'm at the National Health Law Program. Again, I don't think this is a conflict, but just in case, I'm the chair of the Certification Commission for Healthcare Interpreters, which has developed competency standards for assessing interpreters in healthcare settings.
Good morning. I'm Donna Washington. I'm an internist at the Greater Los Angeles Healthcare System and UCLA. And I receive funding from the Department of Veterans Affairs to conduct health disparities research on determinants of healthcare disparities within the VA healthcare system. I'm also on the steering committee for the VA Principal Deputy Undersecretary for Health group that's addressing health disparities.
I'm Ed Habernack. I'm a cardiologist at the City Hospital in Denver, and I'm a faculty at the University of Colorado Medical School. I'm PI on one grant and a co-investigator on another grant that looks at the effect of bias and discrimination on healthcare outcomes.
Good morning. I'm Sean O'Brien. I'm a biostatistician at Duke University Medical Center. I've been involved with a couple previous NQF projects, including a measure testing task force and a couple of hospital outcomes projects. The group that I'm with at Duke works with several medical professional societies with their databases, and so I'm frequently involved with submissions to NQF, and so in past activities I've mentioned my involvement with the Society of Thoracic Surgeons database as a conflict.
Good morning, I'm Ellen Wu. I'm with the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network, and we receive a grant from Kaiser Permanente. I think that's probably the big thing to disclose.
Thank you. Last year I did receive an honorary. I often speak on cultural barriers to clinical research, and last year I did receive an honorary.
I'm Marshall Chin. I'm a general internist and health services researcher at the University of Chicago. The conflict of interest statement was pretty lenient in terms of like a low bar, so I'll just go over what the low bar. Research grants from NIH, ARC, Merck Company Foundation, Hartford Foundation, Commonwealth Fund, American Diabetes Association, Committees of the Midwest Clinicians Network, Institute of Medicine, CMS, Robert Johnson Foundation, ABIM, AAMC, Asian Association, Pacific Islander Health Organization, National Association of Health Centers, VA, Indian Health Service, American College of Cardiology, NCQA, a number of general memberships that I don't think are problematic.
Good morning. I'm Mary Maryland. I'm faculty member at Chicago State University and a nurse practitioner at a private company. I have no disclosures.
I'm Colette Edwards. I'm a gastroenterologist. Until very recently, I was with Cigna Healthcare as your National Medical Director for Health Disparities, and I have nothing to disclose.
I'm Francis Liu. I'll disclose I'm a psychiatrist from UC Davis. I have nothing to disclose.
I am Len Epstein. I'm Senior Advisor for Clinical Quality and Culture at HRSA, Health Resources and Services Administration, and I don't have anything to disclose.
I'm Denise Cora Bramble. I am a professor of pediatrics at George Washington, and I'm a senior vice president at Children's National Medical Center. In terms of issues to disclose, I've been a chair of an advisory board for Pfizer. I am a fellow of the Academy of Pediatrics and also a consultant. I am a member of the D.C. Physician Advisory Subcommittee for Unison/UnitedHealthcare, treasurer and board member of the Academic Pediatric Association.
Okay. Is there any questions that you have for your colleagues, anything you wanted to discuss? Typically, it's no. I would say the reasons that you listed are exactly why we've asked you to be here, so this is a good thing. But we do like to run through this in case there's any concerns. I'm going to leave and go to the next meeting, so please don't be offended as I walk out. Thank you.
Uh,
I'll just add my welcome. I'm Helen Burston. I don't usually sound like this, but I do live with small viral vectors known as children. I'm the Senior Vice President for Performance Measures at NQF. Great to see so many familiar faces, and thank you all for being here. We really view this as being an incredibly important piece of what NQF can do, and I think we really want to build on the work that Dennis and others have done on our previous disparities committee to really think through what we should do prospectively as a measure comes to us, to think through how we handle it, should it be something we should consider always being stratified as an example, as you talked about it in the report. So we really look forward to your guidance. We really do see this as something we will take from this committee and just build into all of our committees going forward. So thank you.
I am going to do a brief introduction and recap. Some of this information you did receive during the orientation call, and for those of you who weren't able to call in, it will be new for you. You don't have a copy of the slides, but they are projected right behind you. For folks who have laptops, not too many in the room, but we do have internet access if you do have a laptop. There is, you know what, we have a few cards that have the username and password, then we'll pass those around.
Username is Laley, L-A-L-E-Y, and the password is 00800, and it works.
And we have introduced ourselves. This is the main project staff.
Hi, I'm Robin Nishimi. I was the founding chief operating officer for NQF, and now I'm a consultant helping NQF with this project. Pleased to have you on board.
So again, the main purpose of the project, we are looking to establish recommendations for approaching measurement of healthcare disparities across settings and populations, and to also then endorse a set of consensus standards for measuring and publicly reporting on disparities in cultural competency. And this particular project, we do have it broken up into two specific phases. The first phase, which we're working on today, is focusing on reviewing a very comprehensive commission paper in which will help us begin to establish that approach for measuring healthcare disparities. And the second phase consists of our traditional consensus development process, in which we will review and look at a set of consensus standards to hopefully provide recommendations for endorsement. Our timeline across the two phases, our meeting obviously is today, July 11th and 12th. Following this meeting and the recommendations we receive from the committee, the commission paper will go out for what we call public and member comment. That's a time that we allow our members and the public to provide specific comments on the content of the paper, and we're looking to finalize that paper and to finalize the recommendations of the committee a little bit later this year in September. Concurrently happening will be a call for measures. We're hoping to launch the call for measures as soon as possible. So August is the start date for that call for measures to be launched, allowing measure developers to submit measures for consideration. Following that call for measures, which will end in October, the NQF staff does a preliminary screening of those consensus standards before they're presented to the committee. So we're looking at a second in-person meeting where the committee will review those consensus standards and provide recommendations for endorsement in December, early January. So we don't have an exact date yet, but as we progress throughout the project in the coming month or so, we will have a better sense of a more exact date, because I know that's a busy time with the holidays. Finally, following that second in-person meeting, we do continue on with our traditional process of consensus, where we do have the standards posted for comment, as well as a voting period, and looking to wrap up an endorsement in June of 2012. So quickly, I know you all are probably familiar with this, but just wanted to quickly recap some of our historical work that NQF has done on disparities to date. Began about 10 years ago in 2001 when we had a small workshop with some key experts who really helped NQF begin to think about healthcare quality for minority patients. And out of that workshop were 10 specific recommendations that were used to engage stakeholders to begin to think about disparities and healthcare quality for minorities. Following that work, we have our disparity-sensitive measures project for the ambulatory care setting. During this project, we did endorse 35 disparity-sensitive measures appropriate for the clinician level. You all do have a full copy of this report in your materials. And finally, most recently, we did a project in cultural competency where we endorsed a framework and 45 preferred practices around cultural competent care. I've provided the executive summary of that report with your materials. We are, of course, happy to provide the full comprehensive report for that as well. I'm going to pass over this. This is an outline of the commission paper, which we'll be getting an overview of that paper in briefly. So the main meeting goals today are first, we want to talk about recommendations for identifying disparity-sensitive measures. We also want to then review, once we have those recommendations, on applying that to our current NQF portfolio of measures. We also want to seek recommendations, again, on methodological considerations for measuring disparities. And finally, an approach on how NQF can really look at measuring disparities prospectively. So with that, I just remembered I did not give my audience and team from Massachusetts General Hospital a chance to introduce themselves. And before you do, I'd just like to allow the folks on the phone, if there's anyone on the phone who is called in either as a committee member or as an audience member, I'd like to give them a chance to introduce themselves. Okay.
Joel Weissman, Health Policy Researcher at the Monash Institute for Health Policy. And Joe Bettencourt, Director of the Disparity Solutions Center at Mass General Hospital.
What's the planned distribution of the white paper once it's completed?
We don't have a specific distribution plan. I mean, it's something that will remain intact with the project, obviously. It will be available for the public and the members for viewing. Did you have a specific question around the distribution of the paper?
It was more in the context of how available and what kind of awareness would be made that this exists.
As part of our process, the paper will be posted and available to NQF members and the public on our website, and the authors are free to publish it in what form they, you know, may wish to submit it to a journal as well.
Yes. Sure.
So my question has to do with sort of both this meeting as well as more generally this charge of the committee. When you look at the four different bullets there, the first three generally have to do with measurements, and the fourth is more or broader in terms of an approach for addressing disparities. One of the very nice things about Joel and Joe's paper was it talked about those issues, but then talked a lot of them about implementation in terms of, you know, in some ways what incentives you might build into the system to reduce disparities, as well as issues regarding trying to avoid unintended consequences. And in many ways, those latter two parts are at least, if not more important than sort of the measurement issues. And so I'm wondering, to what extent are we supposed to concentrate on just, like, associated with measurement issues and the list of disparity measures versus that second and third parts that Joel and Joe also talk about in terms of incentivizing and then design systems so that you avoid bad things happening?
That's a good question. We have tried our best to sort of lay out on the agenda an appropriate time frame for achieving all of these goals, but recognizing that some kind of rise to the top more than others. So the main focus is first to really look at the guidelines for identifying disparity-sensitive measures and to really concentrate, again, on the methodological considerations around disparities measurement. We do also have a good portion of our day tomorrow that will allow us to talk about some of the other considerations that you had mentioned and getting a lot of key recommendations on more of the broader issues for disparities measurement. Did you have a question?
Just one thing to add to that. I think that fourth one, again, is still, as I read it, still kind of an insider NQF question for you in some ways. Obviously, it's a bigger question than that, but I think in some ways we'd like to have you help us understand as a measure comes to NQF in any project, cardiovascular surgery, whatever the case may be, how should we approach that prospectively? What kind of information should they have to submit on the submission form, for example, about evidence of disparities? What should be submitted by the three-year mark when the measure's been in use to justify it? It's those kinds of issues we don't want to have to go back retrospectively as you're going to help us think through tomorrow and say, this is disparity sensitive, but instead think through prospectively how we do this. So just as an example, the Child Health Quality Committee this past year looked at a measure of low birth weight, and the committee immediately went, ooh, this is a measure really hard to look at in the aggregate. It was a population health level measure. So this is one that should always be stratified. And it was one of those things, again, made us think that we needed to have some logical process where a committee looks at something and says, this is really high priority. This is a measure that should never be looked at unless you have the strata to be able to look for disparities. So that's kind of what we're thinking, if that helps.
Any more questions? So we're going to move into a presentation from Mass General on the paper.
Great. Oh, do we have a clicker to advance the slides?
You can cue me to advance them. I'm the clicker.
Clicker, all right. All right, thank you very much. We're very honored to be here today. Before we begin, I'd like to just acknowledge our co-authors. This was really a team effort of many of the staff and friends of the Disparity Solutions Center, including Alex Green, Greg Meyer, Sarita Tan-Magrori is in the room with us, Jake Nudell, Jessica Zeidman, and Emilio Carrillo. Next slide. The purpose of this report, as we understood it, was to provide guidance to the NQF Steering Committee charged with selection and evaluation of the disparity-sensitive measure. And it really is all about providing guidance from what we learned from the literature and from our experience in working together on a number of disparity-sensitive issues. The expertise in this room, obviously, is very impressive, and so we don't need to in any way say that this is the way something has to be done. It's really to raise issues and hopefully foster some discussion going forward. The second purpose is to describe methodological approaches to disparities measurement, which we spent a fair amount of time on, and to identify some cross-cutting measurement gaps in disparities. I also want to just make a couple comments about some terms. We talk, there are people talk about health disparities, which really focus on health status and outcomes and raise a lot of issues about the accountability of the provider. This report is more focused on health care disparities. We rely on the IOM definition of racial ethnic disparities in quality that are not due to access-related factors, clinical need, preferences, or appropriateness. So it's really about more about the provision of care rather than thinking about disparities in general. At least from the perspective of this report, I think, though, in terms of those bullets that Marshall mentioned earlier, it may be that you want to extend that to reduction of health disparities generally.
Also, early on in the discussions that we had about beginning this report, we decided to focus on racial, ethnic, and language proficiency disparities. We did that not because other disparities with women, the disabled, gay and lesbian populations, there are a number of other populations that exist that that have and experience disparities, but we felt like the evidence on racial, ethnic, and language disparities were a little bit more developed. The efforts to develop measures on other populations are in the developmental phase, and we thought that there was plenty to write just on those populations, and so we decided to limit our comments to those. Next slide. The outline of the report and what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about background racial ethnic disparities and data collection. Joe will do kind of a tag team approach. Joe will do numbers 1 and 2. Then I'll take over and talk about disparities, measures, and indicators and some methodological approaches, and then hand it back to Joe to wrap up with quality improvement in public reporting and some of our policy recommendations. Next slide.
Great. Well, I want to thank everybody so much for giving us this opportunity to put this together. Hopefully it was some good bedside reading for you all at some point. It was, I think, went into a lot of different places, and again, as Joel mentioned, food for thought. It's humbling to get a chance to be with you all. It's rare that I think we all get a chance to be together and tackle these issues, so I thank you for your time and look forward to sharing some of our thoughts. Background, quite simply, in the paper, we tried to make the case for why this is important, the impact of disparities on cost, quality, and safety, and then really highlight the fact that when we think about measurement, we clearly see that our ability to really measure disparities is going to be the foundation for any interventions to address them. And so we talk about the fact that even on the aspect of data collection, race ethnicity data collection, we have a long way to go, and then taking it to that next step of measurement is what we're looking at, but certainly the key part of the foundation for disparities development and intervention development. Next slide, please. We tried to put up front in the paper as well a bit about data collection. In this room, we have some of the top talent, some of the people who've been working on this since day one, particularly Ramana and others, who I think have really set the tone nationally for this issue. We chose to really lean on the most recent IOM report on race, ethnicity, and language collection, and so we summarize the particular categories and approaches that report has set forth, but really also endorse efforts of NQF, HRET, and other efforts that have, I think, broke significant ground here. We just pasted in here what the selection criteria or the data collection criteria are and the approach. I will mention that we highlight in the paper the upcoming conundrum I think we're going to face around multiracial populations and how we're going to need to sort that out. We tried to talk a little about the importance in our learnings over the last 5 to 7 years around data collection and training of registrars, training of folks who are gathering this information, how to collect it sensitively, how to do public awareness campaigns, a lot of information there I think that we're going to need to highlight. Joel has done a lot of work around this topic of indirect estimation and studied it quite a bit. We talk about the gold standard being collecting the information from the patient, but really needing to think about issues around indirect estimation, surname analysis, geocoding, and the like that might be used in the shorter term. And then finally, really thinking about how to kind of hardwire this work into where we're going with HIT and the meaningful use and all these other issues. So those are some of the key things we wanted to cover. Next slide, please. We also provided here the criteria for data collection around language proficiency with the caveat that the IOM really talks about the importance of local customization of language categories so that those might be different depending on where you are. So that was the background and the data collection piece. I'll turn it back over to Joel, who will cover, again, sections 3 and 4, and I'll close this out with an overview of kind of lessons learned and some other key policy pieces.
Thanks, Joel. Next slide. Back up one and just to follow up with the data collection recommendation, directly reported race, ethnicity, and language is the preferred method, as Joe said. We need to solidify and support the infrastructure for race, ethnicity, and language data collection. Joe mentioned the clear guidance from the IOM. And then We just felt like in the short term where direct report of race ethnicity is not feasible, that indirect estimation can be put into place immediately, and you can actually use it for a lot of population-based analyses. So next slide. So now we sort of get into some of the meat of the recommendations of the report, and we wanted to start by saying that a lot of work has already been done by the NQF, and that when we reviewed that work, you know, we basically came out and said that we certainly endorsed the guiding principles from the 2008 NQF report, National Voluntary Consensus Standards for Ambulatory Care. And they listed these five principles: prevalence, impact of the condition, impact of the quality process, was there a quality gap, and the ease and feasibility of improvement of quality process. And what's sort of not stated there is each of those principles relates to minority populations, not just populations in general. But that being said, we thought that prevalence and quality gap were two things to really be highlighted, that you would not want to have a condition, whatever that may be, that might be disproportionately prevalent among a minority population and not consider that for some sort of disparity measurement. And then the quality gap, if we go to the next slide, our recommendation is that if you look at all the NQF measures, and I guess there are around 700 right now, of quality of care for ambulatory, institution-based settings, disease-specific measures, cross-cutting measures, that we just felt like they should be crosswalked with the literature on known areas of disparities. In particular, the ARC Disparities Report has a lot of information on that, but other areas other known sources of literature as well. And any of the NQF measures that can be matched to known disparities should basically be considered disparity-sensitive measures. And then finally, we felt it was important, and we mentioned this in the report in Section 5, but just to talk about that now, is that we ought to integrate these recommendations with the National Priorities Partnership and the Measurement Applications Partnership, because there are a lot of other efforts going on right now to develop measures for healthcare reform and other purposes that ought to be integrated with these activities. Next slide. This is something which we thought would help explain how the Section 3 on measure selection is organized and structured, and we think that it's worth thinking about this in terms of an algorithm. This actually came about as well as with some of our discussions with the NQF. But if you think about it, first you might think about known disparities that exist either currently or in the past four specific or similar measures that currently exist among those 700 measures. So you look at the 700 measures, and then and maybe you've already collected race and ethnicity data, if there are known disparities in the literature or on the data that you collect, then obviously it's then we think it should be a disparities measure. But there may be examples where no data exists, or where the data are not sufficiently stratified by race and ethnicity, or they exist and maybe at this point show no disparities, but it may be that there's a problem with the sample size, or maybe there's a problem with actually how we measure it. And in those cases, we developed some, again, mostly from the literature, but some new criteria that we think ought to be considered for thinking about current measures or measure development in the future. And the reason is that based on the experience of our research, of our doing research in this area, and looking at the literature, where you tend to find disparities are in these categories. So, for example, care with a high degree of discretion, you tend to find more disparities among vulnerable populations than in care, for example. The contrast would be care that is highly evidence-based with a lot of a consensus on what to do. Some of the work that I've done with Romana, looking at the Health Quality Alliance data, you know, aspirin after discharge, if there's with AMI, if there's already a lot of consensus on what to do, you're not going to necessarily find that many disparities. Communication-sensitive services tend to find more disparities than others, obviously, especially with patients of limited English proficiency, but also with racial and ethnic minorities that may have various cultural issues to deal with. We mentioned here tobacco cessation for congestive heart failure patients. The third area would be lifestyle changes, diabetes self-management. Wherever it's required to try and engage the patient beyond the doors of the office where the clinician is seeing that patient face-to-face, If you're looking at measures about lifestyle changes, those tend to be areas where you're likely to find more disparities. And then outcomes rather than process measures, kind of related to that lifestyle change and patient engagement issue. But again, once you deal with situations in the communities or family life or other kinds of cultural impacts, that there are likely to be differences. You're likely to find more differences in outcomes rather than in process measures. And then we also, at the end, and I think this last bullet almost ought to be added as a fifth criteria, and that is to really consider measures along the clinical pathway. A lot of times these process measures, you know, you tend to sort of pick ones that are available and that are well vetted, but then you miss steps along the clinical pathway that really might impact outcomes down the line. And the example that we give in the report is renal transplant, where it's not just about referral to specialists, it's about, you know, are they able, if they get referred for transplant, are they able to get the workup? If they get the workup, are they able to understand the many of the bureaucratic and follow and be able to afford, in some cases, many of the bureaucratic requirements to actually receive a transplant, and then do they actually receive a transplant? But there are other conditions, we believe, that have a number of steps along the clinical pathway, and that it's important to consider other steps. And this is where I think the clinical expertise on this panel would really come into play. And then the final category that we talk about is where we believe that in the literature has started to show where disparities may exist, but there really are no good quality measures that exist at this point. And if I go to the next slide, we call these disparity sentinel measures, and they're created specifically as measures where research has shown that disparities exist. They're developed based on a review of the literature, and the best example that comes to play, and we do this at Mass General Hospital, is there's been a fair amount of research that has come about recently on pain management in the emergency department, and yet there really are no good quality measures out there that are being used. And so at Mass General now, they've started to do some chart reviews, they started to measure, and they started to collect these data, and they're monitoring it just like you would monitor any sort of other sentinel type of event. So this is where we think that it's another a tool to, I guess, put in the toolbox and to think about measures that should be developed and maybe aren't at this point. Next slide. And then, you know, when we started looking at and reviewing some of the 700 measures for NQF, it was a little overwhelming, and we tried to make some sense about it. And this was a categorization that we came up with that we think may have some value just in terms of dividing up the types of disabilities measures. It's not really criteria. These are categories. And these are explained in a little bit more detail in the report, but basically ones that focus on practitioner performance, ones that focus or are based on consumer surveys of patient experience, then you go to healthcare facility performance, ambulatory care sensitive conditions, kind of get their own category, cultural competency, and patient centeredness. There's a lot of overlap between these categories, but we thought that it would be a useful way to sort of think about and group some of the measures. And then what we actually started to do with it, that we recommend that perhaps NQF do this in a systematic fashion, if we look at the next slide, is to go through each of the measures. And then, so here's an example where we start up with practitioner performance measures. First of all, determine some of its characteristics. So the column three is the type of measure, whether it's condition-specific or cross-cutting. And try and understand a little bit more about the root of the potential disparity, whether it seems like the literature suggests that it's something that the provider can do that may be responsible for some of the disparities, whether it's more about patient engagement and patient base, whether it's systemic, or whether it has to do with basically affordability issues, which we call health insurance, and then think about whether it's structural, process, or outcome. Next slide. We can have questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, just a quick question. I wasn't sure what PM stood for in the, is it process?
Process measure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry, I know.
Thank you. I wouldn't have seen your part last one. I wasn't sure.
Process,
thank you.
PM, process measure, O is outcome, and then S would be structure.
Okay.
Sorry. Now we get into the methodological approaches to disparities measure, how to measure, measure and monitor. And I was just having a conversation before the meeting started, and I actually think that probably 95% or more of people that that do work in disparities, especially in the clinical setting, don't realize some of the complexities involved with especially tracking things over time. And I think that's where, you know, it's, you don't have kind of one point that stays still. You've got a lot of moving parts. And we cover all these sections in the report. I'm going to go over just a few of them, given the time limitations in this presentation. So if we go to the next slide, the first point, and I think this is potentially one of the more controversial points that we make, is that when you're choosing a reference point, we're taking the position that the choice of the reference group should be the historically advantaged group. There are other groups to consider, the largest group, the group with the best performance, and so on. But we think in reviewing the disparities literature that actually there are some perhaps unintended consequences if you don't choose the historically disadvantaged group to the extent that that could drive some resource appropriations later on down the road. Next slide. And here's the, you know, the I teach this in a class every summer, and this is a slide I use that really displays the differences approach. You know, the question is, did black-white disparities get better or worse between 2000 and 2010? And here's, you know, you can look at the absolute difference, or you can look at the ratio, and the answer is really both. Depending on how you do it, you could say that disparities got worse or disparities got better. And the arithmetic is in the report. I won't bother going through that now. But if you go to the next slide, the take-home message is that absolute and relative changes in disparities can yield different conclusions on whether or not gaps are closing. And actually, I think you also might, although we don't do it as much, but if you compare institution to institution, depending on whether you look at changes over time in terms of relative or absolute measures, you could find the same sorts of issues. You have similar issues with favorable versus adverse events. Again, you know, did the patient get the service or did they not get the service? You know, one would be a difference maybe of 90% versus 92%, the other, or let's say 98% versus 96%, you know, and the other could be a difference of 2 versus 4. One could be a difference of 200% difference. The other could be a very small percent difference. Again, it's playing with numbers, but it really makes a difference when you report these sorts of things publicly to find out that there's a twofold difference or there's a 2% difference. Really makes a difference in terms of how it's seen in public. And so our recommendation is that generally you need to calculate both types of statistics. If they're consistent with each other, fine. Pick the one that's easiest to report. But if they're not, if they conflict and if they give you different messages, then I think at least in terms of reporting that needs to be noted somewhere and that it you know, allow readers to make their own interpretations whether they think in this case a ratio is more important than an absolute difference. Kind of, it depends so much on the particular clinical condition and the particular measure that's selected. Next slide. We go into some detail on paired versus summary statistics. By pairwise comparisons, I mean, you know, if you wanted to look at black-white or Hispanic-white. And what happens is if you have a lot of different subgroups, that does not become very report-friendly, especially when you start looking at changes over time and improvements. You get a lot of different comparisons. I can tell you that I worked with Massachusetts on a state report card, and you know, there are a lot of different measures, and the idea is that you want to make it as simple and user-friendly as possible. And so the big advantage of summary statistics is that they can address these issues by really taking a lot of information and summarizing it in one number. But, you know, unfortunately, that has a lot of disadvantages in the sense that it can obscure important information, in particular directionality. What we found in, for example, we use a summary statistic for pay for performance to reduce disparities in Massachusetts. And in fact, in a lot of situations, the disadvantaged minority population actually gets better quality of care than the white population or a particular institution, and yet that would show up as a disparity that may not be eligible, for example, for pay-for-performance. So those sorts of things need to be investigated. So pairwise comparisons, we believe, using the historically advantaged group as the reference point, should be checked to see if the summary statistic reflects superior care received by the disadvantaged group. And if so, you just need to sort of consider the context of the report and what the relevant policy goals are. And they at least need to be made explicitly, because what happens with a lot of these disparity indexes is that they really are not as transparent as and understandable compared to these some of the pairwise comparisons, which are really right out there. So they're useful, but they need to be explained in detail, we think. And next slide. The next issue is sample size considerations. And, you know, clearly when you, even on the national level, some of our racial ethnic minorities in large national surveys can result in very small sample sizes. The smaller the numbers, the more likely disparities will reflect chance rather than true differences. And there are a number of recommendations that we make that are pretty commonly used in both research and in quality reporting. Again, I won't go into them in more detail other than to mention them here. You can roll up categories. In fact, generally, when you look at subdivided racial and ethnic categories, the idea is to roll them up into those five OMB categories. But sometimes, and you know, I've done this myself, minority versus non-minority, but you know, when you do that, of course, again, the danger is it obscures some of the potential differences that may exist among subgroups. You can use some of the summary statistics or summary indexes that I mentioned. You can also use composite measures for quality measures. In other words, instead of just the classic one is the composite measures that are reported for the Hospital Quality Alliance. You know, you've got five or six different measures for CHF or five or six different measures for AMI, and you can roll those up into a single composite, and that can help with some of the numbers problem. And then you can combine data for multiple years. That being said, I think the other point that we make in the report is that, you know, for high-stakes reporting, you may have to roll up numbers of minorities in order to make them statistically stable. But at the same time, for quality improvement purposes, it may be worthwhile to look at those racial and ethnic minority subgroups to see what's going on. It can be of interest to your clinical providers, and it can be interesting to administration as well in terms of kind of monitoring what's going on. But when the numbers are small, the statistics just say basically that you can't really use them. Next slide. Risk adjustment and stratification, we spent a fair amount of time on, and, you know, basically case mix adjustment and stratification are ways to avoid some of the...
Joe, yep. Could you hold for just a second? I have a question.
I have a question on the subgroups. Did you factor in also geography? I'm from Texas, and I know originally from San Antonio. When we look at San Antonio versus Houston, for example, San Antonio, the Hispanics are like me. I'm a sixth generation. Versus Houston, where there is a very large population of Central American, and it's really very distinct in every aspect of healthcare. So from that aspect, I think that's a very important point. The subgroups is very important. So I don't know if you even look geographically, because I know particularly with the Central American, they're really now migrating to different areas of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, it's an excellent point. And what we're saying there is that, you know, after you get to five OMB categories, then there are a lot of approaches that exist to get into a lot more granularity. And it's difficult to settle on a granular list of racial and ethnic categories that work everywhere in the country. And so the recommendation that we make is exactly what you're saying, depending on the locality, that you should, after you get, you know, make sure that it rolls up again, but try and figure out what are the categories that make sense for your particular population. Joe, do you want to? Okay. So, yeah, I would say that. So I mentioned that these are ways to avoid punitive effects, especially of pay-for-performance and other types of high-stakes reporting that affect providers with disproportionately large, poor, and vulnerable populations. The issues there are that when you tend to risk adjust, first of all, you really obscure all the racial and ethnic or the subgroup differences. And a lot of people are a little bit concerned that it lowers the bar in terms of if minorities are receiving poor quality of care, somehow it excuses the provider for that because you're risk adjusting based on performance elsewhere. And then it also, the other disadvantage of risk adjustment is that it allows providers to perhaps focus on the majority population and improve quality of care there without really improving quality of care for disadvantaged populations. So there are some issues. Stratification, you know, its biggest advantage is that it's more transparent. To be honest, you're still in some ways saying, well, you know, this is the quality of care for minority populations, and we're going to compare those to other settings, and that may be better or worse than the majority population. But at least it's obvious in front of you what categories you're looking at it. So for that reason, mostly, we recommend that stratification should be performed when there's sufficient data to do it, and that risk adjustment, though, can still be appropriate, especially when you've got when performance is usually related to outcomes or proxy outcomes that are highly dependent on community factors beyond a provider's control when you're really talking about quality measurement. Next slide. And now I'm going to turn it back over to Joe.
Okay, so just to bring this to a conclusion here, we talk about priorities and options for quality improvement in public reporting, and really see NQF's kind of vision very well aligned with what we're trying to do with the disparage-related work. So we're trying to really, with the development of these measures, achieve a variety of things, monitor progress towards disparage reduction, inform consumers and purchasers, stimulate competition, stimulate innovation, and promote values. To Marshall's point, we tried to spend a lot of time kind of picking people's brains and also looking at real-world experiences around kind of unintended consequences, untoward consequences from this work. And so we highlighted a couple of different things, particularly issues that have been covered both anecdotally and otherwise around paper performance and public reporting that have particular relevance to disparities. So this concept of kind of cherry-picking and lemon-dropping as a way to make your measures look better, the rich get richer, so certain organizations who have more resources actually doing better around paper performance. We talk about teaching to the test, and we give the example of a way that people address measures by simply instituting antibiotics for anybody who comes in with a cough, absent, you know, make sure they get their door-to-door needle time right. You know, could that be done around disparage-related issues? Gaming the system. We talked a little bit about the ability of minorities to benefit from kind of this kind of general QI versus targeted QI, and then this growing field of recognition on kind of between and within institution disparities. Next slide, please. We tried to touch a bit on kind of what do we see out there right now, and on the federal and state side, we talked a bit about how certain states, for example, Massachusetts being one of them, has mandated the collection of race, ethnicity, language, and highest level of education for all hospitals and health plans. And that has been a pretty good experiment now, although we haven't done well as well around moving towards routine monitoring and measurement. But we do have hospitals that have demonstrated that this information can effectively be collected. Health plans as well, we'll talk more about health plans in a moment, but the National Health Plan Collaborative, several of the health plans who are here, have done great work in this regard as well, and I think those provide significant lessons learned. We have seen some statewide health disparities report cards, but their primary focus has been just stratifying health outcomes by race, ethnicity, on occasion looking at certain measures, but again, I think there's something to be learned there, but perhaps looking more at kind of general health outcomes, prevalence, and epidemiology, less on particular measures, and we might be able to learn, I think, more around statewide efforts in that regard. Next slide, please. From the standpoint of health plans, again, National Health Plan Collaborative being the optimal example, but we do see certain routine collection of race, ethnicity, data collection continuing to be a challenge for health plans for a variety of reasons. There's indirect estimation. We have others who are doing some direct collection, geocoding and surname analysis as well. We have seen in some of our work that local smaller plans can kind of get data from the state, get data from different places that allow them to provide better profiles of their member race, ethnicity, and language, as opposed to some of the challenges that larger national plans face. So something to keep in mind and to explore as you go forward. Next slide. We provide here an example of the work that Aetna is doing, going beyond race, ethnicity data collection to the development of their first racial and ethnic equality dashboard, which has a variety of different elements, including disease prevalence and diversity around their geographic market segments, stratification of CAHPS, and other quality measures that they are now stratifying now and developing as an annual report. Next slide. From the standpoint of hospitals, again, we see that hospitals have been some hospitals have been able to create routine disparities measurement and monitoring tools, dashboards, and/or reports. They have begun primarily by taking off-the-shelf measures and stratifying them by race, ethnicity, and language if that information is available. And again, to Joel's point, connecting these wires is very, very challenging. It's not as easy as just, well, let me take the core measures, let me take the data, and just kind of connect it. Oftentimes, these systems don't speak to each other. They're not connected. Generating these reports, there's a lot of devil in that details, but it has been done. A particular challenge, I think, for hospitals has been small minority sample size for particular conditions, limiting statistically significant comparisons. And we also highlight the importance of an appropriate communication strategy as we try to go public with disparities reporting. There's a lot of concern from hospitals and other organizations that if we say that we're doing work in this area, are our patients going to be concerned? Are providers going to feel blamed? And so as we move towards public reporting, communications is going to be really essential. Next slide, please. We highlight some of the work that we've been doing since 2007 at Mass General Hospital, where we have a disparities dashboard released once a year. This is just the executive summary. It greenlights areas where we don't have any disparities, and we stratify our national hospital quality measures, HEDIS outpatient measures, and as Joel mentioned, we have a sentinel measure around pain management in the emergency room for long bone fracture, so we monitor that. Orange light are areas where we see disparities nationally, and we're exploring them now, mental health and wait time for renal transplantation. We are now stratifying all cause and ambulatory care sensitive admissions, CHF readmissions, and patient experience. And then red light are areas where we found disparities and have developed interventions, something that we think is very, very important, because as you go public, you need to communicate to the community that if you found something, you're doing something about it. Next slide, please. We also publicly report. So anybody could go to MGH Quality and Safety and come and take a look at our equity report, look at our numbers, and look at our improvement stories. And again, we could provide that link in as much as it might be helpful. Next slide, please. So I think we ended with a series of questions related to policy and dissemination. Clearly, we believe that when we move towards public reporting, standardized measures that are easily understandable and actionable are essential. Capitalizing on available measures used for quality reporting is a great place to start. OMB categories used and adapted over time with capacity for local subgroup variation. And then, again, when we debate this issue of public reporting, how should it be used? Should it be used for payment reimbursement or consumer choice, provider incentives? And this packaging piece is really, really important. How do we explain disparities to providers, the public, organizations, think about root causes, link it to quality improvement in a way that doesn't get people to shy away from or be scared of doing work in this area, but instead engaging and really seeing equity as a key part of quality. So that's the end of our formal presentation. You can go to the next slide. We're happy to answer any questions that you all may have, and thank you so much for your time and attention.
Thank you both for the comprehensive and very, very helpful review. We're going to enter the question comment stage now, and I just ask you when you raise your cards to make sure I can see them. So please feel free to get started, and I'll get started with you. I just have a couple of questions about whether you had discussions about a couple points which seem to dance around the edges of your focus around social determinants, and as you touch on that in lifestyle issues, which is to me kind of like a broad opening in some ways to that, and whether because of the close correlation of health literacy to a lot of these issues of culture and language, whether these were discussed and what context you might put it in.
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, if you look at these measures, that MQF has already, they really span the gamut, right? You have something as simple as asthma assessment that Joel highlighted, which is very provider-based, and a piece, and you have others, more outcome-related, that where social determinants play a much larger role. I think what we're recommending is that, you know, these are going to need to be looked at in different ways. And some of these that we would think for certain communities have a greater social determinant causal connection, then how do we make those disparities sensitive, and what are the appropriate pieces that you need to put in place so that you can correctly gather that? It's critically important, no doubt, but the measures, again, run the gamut. as an assessment if something done in the office, something like some of these outcomes, diabetes is the example we gave, you know, that requires a lot more work, and I think that's something that's going to need to be debated around focus and scope among this committee.
I should say, leave it to Dennis to really get at the core issue of the unexplored areas in the report. We did kind of dance around it and address it in a number of different areas, and clearly the social determinants tend to be more important for outcomes, but even for process measures. I was just reading an article recently about racial and ethnic disparities in TRICARE, the military health system, which is, you know, supposed to be uniform care for everybody, looking at asthma care for kids, and they get sent different rates to different specialists, and they get different care even within TRICARE. So even in process measures, social determinants are important. We make the case that to basically not adjust for social determinants when reporting racial ethnic disparities, even though it might be a mitigating factor or an explanatory factor, that it doesn't say that those disparities don't exist. And that I think especially when reporting to the public, people don't want to say, well, you know, this group may have disparities, but if you adjust for health insurance status, the disparity goes away. No, I don't think that is reality, because I think the disparity still exists. I think the other side of the coin, which we touch on a little bit, is in how much to hold the provider responsible, especially when it comes to high-stakes reporting. And a lot of providers will say, you know, you should adjust my patient population for social determinants because there may be communication issues, there may be transportation issues, there may be all these sorts of things which are more difficult and therefore more costly for me to address. And there's one recommendation that we kind of threw in there that I've been exploring recently, which says that if that's the case, then maybe what we ought to think about doing is risk adjusting payments to providers. In other words, if they have a more difficult population, pay the provider more based on the population, but then hold everybody to the same standard in terms of quality outcomes, which is something which I don't think has been tried anywhere, but is something that that might be considered in the future.
Thank you. It's just something that I think as the group goes along, there's clearly a more of an emphasis on these issues of social determinants. You can see it reflected in the healthcare law, and it might be something for further discussion around the way. Why don't we go around the table, starting with Elizabeth, and we'll just do a round and pick up people as
actually mine's not a question, but an offer of a resource. So I noticed that you talked about measuring language in the report and that you weren't sure about the best way to ask it, the two questions, the OMB questions versus preferred language. And it turns out that Leah Carliner and colleagues have done a really nice paper actually showing the sensitivity and specificity of using those two questions and how to phrase it, and I will email you that reference. I think that would be an excellent thing to include because it's really well done.
Thank you. Norman?
Before you go on, could you make sure this one of the staff...
You know what? I'll send it to the whole group. I'll just send the whole group.
Great.
The reference, so you can all have it if you're interested in it.
First of all, selfish comment. I'm just surprised on the dashboard you don't include musculoskeletal care or health as one of the major criteria, especially with our aging population. I mean, I'm a pediatric orthopedist, but there are like 250,000 total hips and being done in the American population. So I'm just surprised it's not one of the categories up there with diabetes and asthma and fractures and trauma, et cetera.
And which dashboard are you referring to?
Well, you had one of the dashboards with the six main health determinants, asthma, cardiovascular disease, I think, one of your slides. It was also with Aetna. Aetna. Go back. They're quality measures. You're measuring... asthma
this is just
care.
An example of what they're doing.
Okay.
This is kind of a real-world example.
Okay. I thought I saw that in your paper, too, but, you know, maybe I'm mistaken.
Yeah, no, I don't think we recommended that you should, I don't think that we recommended particular areas. We were just, this is just highlighting what they're doing, but certainly issues around musculoskeletal, when you think about disability and
right.
and mortality, morbidity, we're with you on that.
Okay. And a question, you're talking about measures and quality of care and quality of life, functional outcomes. I think there's got to be a little more focus on the patient. For example, you talked about some off-the-shelf measures. Let's just say, for example, pain management. It sounds pretty easy. You know, you give morphine, pain's gone, pain isn't. Likert scale, zero to whatever. But Asian men metabolize morphine or codeine at different rates. So presumably their response would be different. Their requirements are different. The other thing, I really impress upon you to focus on the patient. I mean, we're here for this is a quality forum. I mean, if we're measuring quality, we have to look at the patient and the disparity or the specific population we're looking at has different adherence and compliance. I guess compliance is the old term, but they adhere to treatments differently, and that will certainly affect your quality of care. For example, if a kid breaks their arm, I see that a lot. A Manhattan kid family would bring their kid in right away. But if the kid was, for example, not to pick on Asians, but I guess I can because I'm Asian, an Asian kid from Queens would have banana leaves or some type of ointment placed on, and that would affect the quality of life. So that brings up issues of adherence, compliance, etc. The last point I want to make is, we're measuring outcomes and quality of care. The measures have to be specific for the population. For example, I try to make kids walk, and sometimes if I can make a kid walk 10 feet, that's the best thing in the world, okay? But in the eyes of some parents, if a kid never walked before and they're walking 10 feet, that's great. But if their foot's a little turned out or a little turned in, that's the worst result in the world. If you do a total hip in a patient and they can walk more, great. But if they can't sit or if they can't kneel for their religious beliefs or whatever beliefs it is, that's the worst result in the world. So my point to you is I mean, you have all these off-the-shelf measures that you talked about, but we have to focus on the patient and the and there's no point sitting here and measuring infection rates, pain management. I think that's a waste of the brain power in here and your time and my time, unless we really focus on the patient and what the crux of the matter is. And we're here because the populations are diverse, you know, and there's no point measuring mortality, morbidity. Let's measure quality of life and what specifically we're helping with the quality of life of that patient. Sorry to monopolize time. Thank you.
Yeah, on that point, I was just an add-on for further discussions down the line. I was wondering whether you folks had ever looked at the PICCR, went to the PICCR patient-centered care measures, you know, since there was such an extensive amount of work that was done on it.
Yeah, I mean, on slide, so I agree with everything you said, and I think that's really the area that we need to push the most on. But if you look at what's readily available today, it's the least developed. So I think when we talk about off the shelf, it's our recommendation is moving on parallel tracks. I'm going to editorialize a bit here. I believe that we need to look at the measures we have by race and disease, but go a long way at getting our patient experience. Because, you know, if you look at HTAPs alone, right, and you stratify by race and disease, we're seeing some very significant differences by subgroup. And my sense is that we're leaving a lot of voices out there in the dark, that our current mechanisms of really getting at patient experience, getting at some of the issues you mentioned, are really in their infancy stages, making progress in that area. And this is something that we're thinking about from a research standpoint, of really, you know, getting at patient experience in other ways, you know, outside of surveys, other strategies, I think, is going to be critical. And I think that's something that we want to highlight if we haven't highlighted it.
Yeah, we obviously have to use what we have. I mean, there's only so many outcome measures and surveys that are available, but what I've done in children's orthopedics is actually try to validate them at least, and we should at least make an effort to validate it. For example, well, I mean, there's a general survey I can give to every kid, but I worked in Los Angeles and I had a big Hispanic or Latino population. I actually validated that study in those kids, and it presumably worked out. It did work out well, and I feel good about reporting data or with that outcome measure. But yeah. I agree with you.
Thank you, Ma.
So I have a couple thoughts, sort of not just on the paper, but in a broad concept. And one, I just want to sort of register as a little bit of a concern. And I completely recognize and having worked on these issues for the last, whatever, however long, focusing on race, ethnicity, and language disparities. But I do just want to also recognize that, as you guys said, there's a lot of other disparities based on other population. And so one thing that I think might be worth some discussion at some point is, when we are talking about prospectively, how does NQF look at these measures, how do we also think about looking at these measures and developing them for other populations? And in large part, I mean, maybe this is part of my disclosure that I didn't do, but one of my other hats is I co-chair the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights Healthcare Task Force, and this has been a big issue for that task force of making recommendations on all the different types of populations that might be affected, and in large part because people aren't often just in one population group. And so I think that is just, it behooves NQF to sort of explain why the focus of this project is specifically on race, ethnicity, and language, but also how we can use what we've learned, because we have come a long way. And it is amazing when you guys said, you know, we're better off in race, ethnicity, and language than some of these other populations, and that's due to huge work by lots of people, but it's also sort of frustrating that we're not there in some other areas too. So I think it is just an explanation and some background, and then looking how we can address it going forward. The second piece, and I think you guys addressed this to some extent too, was on language. I think that we really do have to make sure the focus is on collecting both language proficiency and language data. And I mention this not because I think this group is, or the paper was sort of lacking in it, but more because of what we're seeing from policy side of things, where because if there's an added cost to doing it, recommendations just came out from the federal government to collect language proficiency but not language. And I can't see how you can get to disparities and identify if you only have, did you speak English very well, well, not well, not at all. And so for the same reasons I think you guys make the case we need to get more granular data on race and ethnicity, I think we have to make that exact same case that we need that shouldn't be granular, but granular data on language and not just a language proficiency standard as we're looking at the measures. And then the third piece, and really this is just a comment, Joel, on your issue about risk adjusting, we actually have been looking at that from the policy angle and trying to make that exact case that if you're looking at an accountable care organization or a medical home or something like that, that there should be some recognition that we do need to risk adjust based on, you know, language to pay for interpreters to translate materials or to cover some of those other issues you discussed or others like the social determinants of health. But if someone's now coming into care, that they might need more care to catch up because of the history of disparity. So I think that sort of dovetails nicely with what you said. It's hard to create sort of the evidence for that, but I think we're trying to make that case that to the extent we can make more of that case through the evidence and through some of the standards that collect it to make the case going forward, again, that would be a good perspective way to sort of go forward. So
wouldn't it be nice if ACOs that served minority and disadvantaged populations were well-resourced rather than
always? And that's like exactly our case. I mean, a lot of what we're saying, I think this dovetails exactly, you know, with the policy developments now, and I apologize, I live and breathe this policy stuff, but that, you know, we're testing all these new payment systems, and if we're not collecting data and stratifying data by race, ethnicity, language, et cetera, we're going to end up with payment systems that work well for the average and not for anybody else, and we're just going to perpetuate the disparities that we've seen going forward. So we're at a perfect time, I think, exactly for this project, but just need to keep all of the policy pieces in mind as much as the standard development.
Thank you. Edward? Oh, Donna, I'm sorry. Get to your card.
Okay.
Thank you, Donna.
Thanks. Joe and Joel, I really appreciate the attention the report pays to sample size as well as to some of the consequences of reporting out for minority-serving institutions. And so the comment I want to make has to do with reporting out by institutions that don't have a sufficient sample size to stratify their population or examining disparities, where they might actually look good, be inappropriately labeled as sort of a non-disparity related institution when in fact they don't have sufficient sample size. And I wonder if you might want to address recommendations for reporting out when the sample size isn't sufficient. I'll give the example of the VA healthcare system. They collect quality and satisfaction data on a sample of patients at each site and have been publishing report cards for the past 3 years. Last year, for the first time with the 2010 report, then they reported out satisfaction stratified by race ethnicity for every single VA facility. And what they did to address the small